Welcome back to Burn the Haystack with Josh and Jesse.
I'm Jesse.
And I'm Josh.
And this is a show all about saving the best and burning the rest.
It sure is. And today we have an action-packed episode, I think.
So much action. This is going to be absolutely mind-blowing, people.
No, we're going to be talking about some stuff that I think is a bit heavy for people. Not heavy, yeah. But like I think it's a question that weighs heavy on people, I should say.
I think when people who have issues with faith talk about faith, especially Christianity, Judaism, and the Bible, this is definitely something that comes up fairly often, at least in my sphere, and that is the God in the Old Testament often seems to be different to the God in the New Testament, right? Like,
yeah.
A lot of the time people think of like Jesus as this hippy-dippy sort of peace-loving, wearing floral wreaths sort of, you know, guy. I don't know, like stroking the lamb, you know, telling a story to the kids. Whereas the God in the Old Testament is kind of more like Zeus throwing lightning bolts down from on high, killing people randomly, giving his stamp of approval to genocides, and just generally kind of being like a temperamental, angry sort of dude. Like, yeah, that seems to be the story.
Yeah. I think that Zeus comparison is a good one. I think a lot of people can like think of the Old Testament God like that, just raining down thunder and plagues and whatever. And so, yeah, you get this kind of, I think a lot of people have this weird picture of God where he's almost like schizophrenic. It's like he's almost like a different God in the Old Testament, the New Testament. And so that's what we're kind of diving into this episode next. Maybe a little bit after that. I don't know. We're going to see how it goes at this stage.
Like we talked to you guys about like the last episode, we're kind of like wanting to go in a different direction. We're wanting to take a break from all the COVID-19 sort of coverage that we've been doing. And we just want to dip our toes in this pool and see where the current takes us, man. So we could be here for the next 100 episodes. Who knows? It might just be that interesting. I don't know, man.
Yeah. I'm sure we could go deep enough.
Yeah.
But this episode is definitely not an all-encompassing answer to that question, but I think it is a helpful start.
Yes.
You know, and like just one idea to help alleviate that burden for people a bit. So anyway, but before we get into that, of course, we have to do the questions of the week.
What's the question of the week this week, Josh?
Are you excited? Okay.
I'm excited, man. My expectations are all the way up here.
Okay, this awesome. This is courtesy of Ask Reddit. You've ever been on that subreddit, it's just people asking questions by user Sal the Dragon, which I just love that name.
Fellow scholar. I'm sure he's a haystack burner.
Surely. Okay, so you are now a supervillain, right? But you're one of those supervillains who has an animal companion. So what is your like supervillain animal companion of choice and why?
Yeah, that's pretty easy.
To like fight by your side, I should say.
Yeah. So like I'm rushing into battle with this creature. They're kind of like my familiar sort of thing.
What do you mean by familiar?
Oh, it's like animal familiar. I don't know, like His Dark Materials. They have like an animal that's like I don't know. It's like a fantasy thing. Sci-fi fantasy thing.
Oh, okay.
All right. So my animal sidekick, that is my representation of my evil corporation and my ideals and my will to dominate. It's a bear. Yeah, it's a bear.
Wow. Why a bear?
Well, a bear has many functions. It can do many things. It can tear my enemies apart. It's got sharp claws, razor sharp teeth. But it's also, you can also ride a bear if it's big enough. Like to think that my bear would be like big enough that I could put a saddle on it and it could just like waddle along and, you know, I could have maybe like a weapon on by my side, and like the sight of my bear and me at the front of my armies just strikes fear into my opponents. But also equally as valuable as being able to tear my enemies limb from limb is the ability to just snuggle with it. I mean, cold winter's nights,
yeah.
You know, a bear is a warm companion when those winds are howling, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like okay. it's like a giant Labrador or giant golden retriever that can kill a lot of people, but also really snuggly.
I'm not really seeing the comparison to a golden retriever very strong, but okay.
It's the fur.
Okay, so any furry animal. It's just like a golden retriever, really.
Okay, it's a giant rabbit or a giant guinea pig that, I don't know. It's got, I don't know, whatever.
Yeah. No,
that's my choice. That is my choice.
That makes sense. Yeah. I was trying to think of like things that are truly terrifying, but like also kind of unique. And I will say one of the comments on that subreddit, I want to mention it, but I don't want to steal it, was a Canadian goose. And I was like, yeah, that's pretty real. Like geese are actually pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
But I don't like birds that much, you know, so I don't think that would be mine. Like I thought maybe like a hawk or something, but I think I'm more ground based. So I was thinking like a rhino could be kind of cool.
A rhino.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like brute force, man. You're just like, that direction, go, you know, yep. And it just goes.
It's like a tank on legs.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. And also, as well, I was also thinking I can ride it. Be kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we were in the same like army or group, I could have the hippopotamus and you could have the rhinoceros.
That makes sense. Yeah. Rhinoceros. Is that from Flight of the Conchords?
Yes.
Yeah, that's it. I was
from
trying to think of it.
Hippopotamus versus rhinoceros. Yeah.
That's so cool. And I just thought, you know, like, how cool is like an armored and blinged up rhino, you know?
Bro.
It would just look cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
In Magic the Gathering, there is a card that was absolutely dominant for a while. It was the Siege Rhino. It was sick. In fact, I'm going to look it up right now to see how cool it is, because it was literally like what you're describing, like a tank on legs. It was just amazing.
I don't know what the first thing I thought of when you said that was like a rhino with a trebuchet on its back.
Okay, well, it doesn't have a trebuchet, but well, if you look, I'm holding it up to the camera. Can you see that?
Oh, that's pretty cool.
It's like a, if
you guys watch the YouTube video, you can see this.
Yes. It's pretty insane as well. It's one colorless, one white, one black, and one green. So for a 4/5 trample, when Siege Rhino enters the battlefield, each opponent loses 3 life and you gain 3 life.
95% of people listening have no idea what you're talking about.
I don't even care. Okay. This is Magic the Gathering, man. You either get it or you don't. If you don't, I'm sorry.
True.
There's nothing I can do for you. All you need to know is that it is a gigantic rhino that has like a tent on top of it, and it's huge. It's amazing. Yeah,
that's cool.
And yeah. It's from the Abzan clan in Tarkir.
All right, that's enough, Jesse. Okay. do you reckon your answer would be different if it was a hero, your sidekick, and you were a hero?
Ooh. That's an interesting question.
Yeah, maybe that should be next week's question of the week.
Maybe if I was a hero, I would have a different kind of bear. Because like if I was a villain, maybe it would be like a grizzly bear. But if I was a... Or maybe like a black bear. And if I was a hero...
It'd be Winnie the Pooh?
It'd be Winnie the Pooh.
Perfect.
Hey, honey bear.
Yeah. Super friendly, dopey bear. Like a panda.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's more like a Disney sidekick than like something that you can bring into battle.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. But, okay, you know what? I'm giving you in advance. Yeah, we're going to talk about that next week. Your hero sidekick animal.
All right.
Awesome. So let's talk about the Old Testament for a moment.
Can I go back to my siege rhino from Magic the Gathering? Because I feel like that would fit right in with some of the Old Testament stuff that we're going to talk about today.
You know, I'm not going to lie. Some of the Old Testament stories could have been much more interesting if there was a rhino with a trebuchet on its back.
Yep. Yep.
Like, even if they just stuck it, like, randomly in the middle of one of the genealogies somewhere, just like, this is the son of this, this is the son of that, then beget that, this is the son of this person, who rode a rhino with a trebuchet on its back into war. Like, wow! And then just goes back into the genealogy.
Yeah. It's like, I actually want to read the Bible now. That's amazing.
I just want to know more about that guy.
Well, what I've always wondered is, like, do you remember when that bit where it's recounting David's mighty men, and then one of them is like, he fought a lion man from Egypt or whatever. I'm like, what is a lion man? Because, not to go back to Magic the Gathering, but in Magic, there are lion people. They're called Leonin, and they're literally like people with like human leg or human-ish legs, and then like a lion's head. It's like,
they're just like upright lions, eh? Like humanoid lions, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Like, did that actually exist? Or is it like, he was strong like a lion and his teeth were like a lion? That would be kind of lame, but I don't know.
I want to look it up, and I also don't want to, because I kind of just want to leave it up to the imagination. And I'm sure if I look it up, it'll be a real buzzkill. Like, oh, it was just this certain group and...
The lion people. They had a lion as their crest and they were called lion people.
Yeah, you're like, oh, well, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah, rather than what I want to picture is like a guy in like full lion shaped armor or something, you know what I mean?
Right.
Just looking awesome.
Ooh, that would be cool. Like what's his name from Warcraft? The you know how they have like the lion shaped
the alliance.
Armor?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember the guy's name right now, but even like if you've ever seen Gladiator, there's a guy in there with like a lion like helmet in there. That movie. Old movie, but a good movie. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so Old Testament. So often, like we were saying before, a lot of people have this idea of the Old Testament God being super, I don't know, just like just seems really different to Jesus. To be fair, I can really see where they're coming from with a lot of things when you say that. It does take a bit of digging and a bit of trying to put your mind into the mind of like the earlier audience reading this, like the people who were there at the time even, and remembering that the Old Testament's it's really old, you know. Like New Testament is 2000 year old literature, which is that's old, but Old Testament, you know, can be like
it's at least 5,000 years old, I think.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, so like that's a lot of generations of people, a lot of time for the way we think about the world to change. Because I feel like as people we've matured a lot too, in a way. Yep. I'm not saying we're better than people back then or something. It's more that the way we think about the world has like advanced, changed, and matured. Maybe, I don't know.
Yes.
Well, in our mind, matured, but it's definitely different.
Well, okay, so we have the benefit of 2,000 years of culture and civilization, which has been influenced by Christianity and the Judeo-Christian sort of worldview. And we have evolved in many ways according to the shape of that worldview. In some cases not, but in many cases, yes. And the other thing, just to go back to your earlier point, is the fact that in the Hebrew scriptures, we have the span of thousands of years. Whereas in the New Testament, we are pretty much situated between the birth of Jesus at the turn of the century, all the way up to Jesus's death, and then several decades after Jesus's death. But that's it. Like, we don't have much more than that. So you're comparing thousands of years of history through many generations and people groups and kings and genealogies to just the span of 5 decades. Maybe less, sort of thing. So
yeah,
it's very difficult to compare the two, but as you said, it is something that we have to grapple with, because when people look at the Old Testament and they see quote unquote angry God, I mean, we can't like ignore that, which is why we're talking about it now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who don't believe in God because of a picture they've had of God based on like things that they've heard about with the Old Testament. Yeah. And I think it can be quite, I think the Old Testament can be quite confronting to us. Because like, I mean, I think we'll talk about this later, but like violence is a big thing. Like people see like the violence, even in the New Testament and stuff, but particularly the Old Testament, they're like, it's so violent, there's so much bloodshed. I feel like even 100 years ago, people were like, that's just, well, maybe not 100, but like 200 years ago, people were like, that's just life. That's just what life is like. No one cared. It's only been sort of recently, like where we're living in this time of way more peace. And, you know, it can often take a lot.
To a certain degree, like we still live in a world where in some parts of the world, violence and bloodshed are still the norm, depending on where you
totally
live.
Yeah. Like, but I mean, the kind of peace that us here in the Western world are experiencing is...
Absolutely.
It's pretty different to the rest of history from what I understand.
You know what it is, Josh?
What?
It's unprecedented.
That word. It's right now. I know like some people will be listening to this podcast in 2 years and be like, what's the big deal about that word? Right now, it's just getting thrown around a lot. As it, what, in March, end of March 2020.
Yeah.
If you want a good history lesson, you can look it up and look up why are people saying unprecedented so much at that time. It'll be good.
It's triggering for us right now.
Yep. But yeah, I think... and so for us, we get really like troubled by that. You know, we're like, oh, like there's people dying. Oh, they're getting hurt and whatever, you know. That's just so foreign. It's become so foreign to us now. Like if you live living in Australia or New Zealand, like some people can be years... of their life, like, you know, a couple of decades even before they even know somebody, they're close to somebody who dies in their life.
Yeah.
Whereas back then, when you're a child, you see people die around you that you know, that kind of thing. It's just normal. I don't know, maybe they're a lot more accustomed to death than we are.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, the fact is that we live in a world where we've never been more prosperous, we've never been more free, and we've never been so far removed from the effects of violence and disease. Well, up until like now, as far as the disease part is concerned.
Yeah,
but, you know, to see somebody, your next door neighbor, die from some sort of preventable infection, from an injury, or to just see somebody die from an injury at work, to see public execution, natural disaster, wipe out half your village, or just a neighboring tribe coming in, raping and pillaging, killing the men, carting the women and the children off in chains. Like, up until the modern era, that was normal for most of the world. So in some cases, like, you know, I really struggle with this because in some ways, I want to say that we're better as a people, but I know that we're kind of not at the same time. Like, we have this moral compass of violence and the sanctity of human life, and it's never okay to kill somebody else, but at the same time, we are guilty of some of the same sins, just in a different way in the modern era. So in some ways, it's like, yeah, we're better than our ancestors, but in other ways, we're not.
Yeah. And so I guess that time we're looking at in biblical times is really different. And I think the way they saw God and the divine was really different too. Like the way they saw human life, but also the way they saw divine life and how humans interacted with the divine. To them, it was really different. And there are a lot of things in the Old Testament that, when you compare it to the world around them at the time, the Old Testament is actually radically different in a lot of ways. So I guess, jumping into it a little bit. So one thing I've been reading about a fair bit recently is like going through Exodus again and Numbers, which can be a bit of a slog to read at time. Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, it's all, could be bit frustrating to read, but I feel like one thing I hear a lot is particular, and this is kind of what we're going to hone in a bit today, is that the Old Testament feels really legalistic at times. It's like God just laying down all of these rules that people have to follow, or they'll get smited or something, you know. I don't know. Do you hear that much, Jesse?
Yeah, no, definitely. That's a question that I have all the time from people, and just like Christians and non-Christians, because I don't know. I feel like we have this misconception that Christians are totally okay with this and non-Christians are the ones who have an issue. But ironically, it's probably been the Christians that I've talked to that have more issues with this. And you could probably put that down to the fact that they're actually reading the Bible, whereas most non-Christians are not reading the Bible. So
yeah,
that makes sense. But yeah, especially like our generation, the millennial generation and Gen Z, I don't know that the boomers really had much of a, I don't know, like when I was growing up, my parents, who are baby boomers, or at least aging Gen Xers, I don't even know, they didn't seem to have as much of an issue with this because they just could put it down to, well, God knows best. So obviously God had good reasons, even if we don't understand the reasons, and that's fine with me. I think the Gen Xers were the ones who kind of started to question things a little bit more and to think, actually, no, well, let's question this. Let's ask why. And I think maybe that tradition has kind of been passed on to us. But it's definitely a big one. I mean, one of the small groups I'm part of is studying Judges right now, and that's one of the questions that is always thrown up, because Judges is also an incredibly bloody book. It's a big one, and it's obviously one that I've struggled with. We've both struggled with on our own in our own walks as well. So
totally. And I guess like the main point that I see a lot of people throw out is they feel like Jesus is all grace and the Old Testament is all law. I hear it all the time. And I would say I probably believed it for a long time. I still think it's easier to see grace in Jesus, in the life and ministry of Jesus, than it is in the Old Testament. But it is definitely present in the Old Testament.
Yeah. It's like Old Covenant, New Covenant sort of. I think we lump those two things in together a lot of the time, where it's like Old Covenant is all about like if you eat the right animals, if you wear the right clothing, if you worship on the right days, if you don't do the bad things, then God's going to be okay with you. And if you don't, well, then, you know, all hell will break loose or whatever, you know. Whereas it's like New Testament is grace, eat whatever you want, wear whatever you want, just do the nice things and trust that you're covered by the blood of Jesus, and everything's going to be fine.
Totally. So I guess what we have to look at first is why and when God gave the law. Now, we kind of already did an episode on the law, which covers a bit of how, more of like its function, how it works. I think maybe in how it was perceived and received. So this is more about a why and when God gave the law. Like, you know, things like you see in Exodus, Leviticus, and like building the tabernacle and the Ten Commandments, and then like laying down all these like really like the clean and unclean stuff that you see all the way through Leviticus, all that kind of stuff. People see that and then they see like look at all this, there's so much that they had to do. But I think if you take a step back and look at it, that starts in like the second half of Exodus. The first half is God rescuing people from Egypt on no merit of their own whatsoever. It's total grace. It's like he steps in and brings them out of Egypt based on absolutely nothing they've done. They did nothing to deserve it that you can read in the story anyway.
They're just there like wallowing in their sort of pain and their grief, and they're crying out, and God hears the cry, but he doesn't enter into any arrangement or covenant. He doesn't tell them, hey, I'll rescue you. I'll just sign on the dotted line, agree to all these terms and conditions, and then we'll make it happen. Like, he goes out of his way and he rescues them before, you know, actually asking anything of them.
Exactly. So he only gives them laws and things to follow after he rescues them. And it's like, that's awesome. You know, it's like on the way into the promised land, he's like, okay, now here's what I want you to look like. And that's the big thing. which is really cool. Like, I don't know. I think a lot of people, they take it out of that frame and they just see all the laws that are given. They don't realize that those are given after the saving has already taken place. Like, they're on their way to the promised land at this point.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have to do that necessarily to get into the promised land.
Yeah. Do we maybe want to do, like, a little bit of revision on, like, I know we already did that whole episode on the law, but to get people up to speed if they haven't listened to that episode, or maybe they just need a refresher on, like, what is the law, what function did it serve, just, like, a really quick one.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, so law, at least in the Old Testament sense, in the Judaic sense, Torah, it just means teaching, right? So the word that we use to translate to law, Torah, we probably shouldn't translate it as law. We should translate it more as teaching.
Mm, or wisdom.
Yeah, or wisdom. That's a good translation as well. So when it comes to thinking about what the law is, especially in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Numbers, we see that, well, number one, we see that the law is laid out, Torah, teaching, is laid out in narrative form, because it's not just static teachings, thou shalt do, thou shalt not do, with no examples. Almost every single time that a teaching is given to the people, there is an example of the people ultimately either living up to it or failing it. Usually it's the latter. So for instance, we see the teaching where thou shalt have no other gods before me, and talking about worship and all that sort of stuff. And what is ultimately followed is the story of the golden calf, where the people, they fail to observe true worship of laying down of idols and only worshiping Yahweh. The other thing, and I'm glad you mentioned wisdom, is that teaching and law are wrapped up with wisdom. Feel free to jump in at any time, by the way.
No, you're doing good, man. Keep going. I'm just cheering from the sideline, like, woo, yeah, you got this.
So wisdom, one of the things that God continually tells his people, not just during these three books, but also throughout the whole Old Testament narrative, is the instruction to listen and hear, O Israel, listen and hear, listen to my voice. In the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, the command to listening to the voice of God is the same as doing the will of God. So the implication is that you will listen and do. There's no such thing in an ancient Hebraic sense of listening and then taking it on advisement, or listening and going, yeah, I don't know. You either listen or you don't listen. There's no sort of middle ground. And so wisdom is about listening to the voice of God, which is what ultimately the very first humans failed to do. When they were put in the Garden of Eden, and they were instructed to eat of any tree except for the tree of knowing, Tov and Ra, the tree of knowing good and bad, they are then given a choice. Are they going to listen to the voice? Are they going to live within the wisdom of God? Or are they going to listen to another voice? The voice inside, the voice of the serpent. And ultimately, they choose to not listen to God's voice, and therefore consequences follow, which we are all now living in. So the other aspect is that Israel would listen to the voice of God, because listening and obeying are the same thing. And the implication is that if you listen and obey, you will live within God's wisdom and you will be transformed. And that is what God is ultimately wanting for his nation of priests. He wants a transformed nation that, in the same way that he promises Abraham, will bless all the nations through. That's the idea. Why continually throughout the prophets, especially, there is the cry that God would one day transform the people's hearts of stone into hearts of flesh, hearts that will listen to God and will live in his wisdom and will live in his ways. That's the purpose of the teachings. That's the purpose of the law, is to transform the people so that they will be his true covenant people and so that all the nations will be blessed through them.
Yeah. And I guess speaking about that blessing, like part of the reason it's wisdom is because the ways that God weighs out, like the ways that God lays out how he wants his people to live, they're actually functionally very, like they're functionally better than most other societies at the time. Like they would equal a healthier society where the poor is actually looked after, where there would be less disease because you have things like the Levites distinguishing between what molds and what fleshes and what's unclean, what's clean and unclean. Like it's functionally wise as well. And that functionally wise society is then better equipped to be a blessing both to themselves and to the other nations around them. So it's like this wisdom is like, it's not all just religious, it's actually also functional wisdom as well, which I think is really cool when you look at it like that. So it's a really cool thing that God actually gave at the time. Mm. Should we take a quick break and then we'll come back?
Yeah.
Awesome. So continuing on, this like functional wisdom that God gives, there's also another, I've got basically another 2 points that I think are really cool about it as well, and how it shows grace. Firstly, this is second point or third point, I don't know, we're just kind of riffing through, is that the systems of belief back then in those times, you didn't know what the gods wanted. Like, you had no idea what the gods wanted to be happy. Whereas, like, the God of Israel lays out exactly, like, very clearly, hey, here's what I want you to do. This is pleasing to me. This is pleasing. Now that you've been saved, I've rescued you out. Let me lay out. This is what I think would be best for us in our relationship. And just lays the whole thing out as clear as day. Like, even us today, thousands of years removed from it, can pretty easily see what kind of society and the sort of things that God wanted them to do. Whereas other religions at the time, or other beliefs in like gods, they had no idea. It was trial and error. Like, well, we need rain. Let's do a rain dance. Didn't give rain. Maybe we need a better rain dance. Okay, let's get more people involved. We're still not getting rain. Okay, let's maybe start sacrificing things, that sort of thing. They just would guess. And then they would see something good happen and they're like, oh, the gods must like this. Okay, I guess we'll do it again next time, that sort of thing. So it was a real guessing game. And I think from my understanding, even like the priests didn't necessarily even know, like of these other religions, the priests didn't necessarily even know what the gods wanted. They were kind of guessing too. They were just getting information passed on from priests before them. We're like, oh yeah, the gods tend to like this sort of thing, Maybe some were more advanced, but
Sure that you, on a Wednesday afternoon at about 2:30, Bale really likes a peanut butter and jam sandwich on his altar. Just put a peanut butter and jam sandwich. That usually does the trick. All right, carry on.
It'll be gone in a couple of hours. So don't look. Just leave. So it's not, And I mean, I guess obviously, like for us, we're monotheistics. We believe there is only one God. So it does make sense why the others would have no clear indication.
There's two schools of thought there. There's the first school of thought, which would say that all ancient gods and deities were just figments of people's collective spiritual imagination.
Yeah.
And then there's the other group, which would be like, well, maybe that's true for some deities, but maybe some other deities were also represented by actual spiritual beings who were possibly demonic or at least malevolent in origin to set themselves up in opposition to true God Yahweh. So you can see it from one of those two angles.
I was also, I don't know how I should bring this up, but since we're talking about schools of thought, I was also reading something about how there's some schools of thought that believe that the Christian God Yahweh, or Judeo-Christian God Yahweh, is he's referred to as the God of gods. It's like there are other gods, but he's like the God to be worshipped.
Right.
Which was it? I don't know if I buy it, but it was an interesting read anyway. So I guess there's that school of thought too, which is just worth bringing up as a comparison, depending on whatever you believe.
If you read the Exodus narrative, there's definitely no part where Yahweh God says, hey, all the Egyptian gods are rubbish and pointless and they don't actually exist. Actually, the implication is that Yahweh is triumphing over the Egyptian gods throughout the 10 plagues. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, you could argue, I mean, we're getting a little bit distracted, but you could argue is either God, like, not, like, maybe it's harder, maybe it would have been harder back then for God to argue that gods aren't real. Yeah, I mean, it would be harder to convince somebody that their gods aren't real. It would be easier to convince them that, look, this God is the true God, if that makes sense, rather than say your gods aren't, I don't know, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's evidence all the way throughout Israelite history that Israelites, they generally held Yahweh as being supreme God over all the gods, but they also, many of them, worshipped other gods. Like, you know, when we see Gideon, he's like there with all his other gods everywhere else.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to worship Yahweh, but then we're also going to worship, you know, Baba Ganoush, whatever, I don't know. I should have just said Baal or Asherah, I don't know.
You should have. That's probably not the right. But, yeah. You're right. And that's, I guess, that does play into this interesting, like, thought train that God actually just laid out. Here's what I want you to do. It's really easy. Well, I guess not necessarily easy, but it's really clear and simple.
That's
just do this. Like, the priest will help. Do this. Make sure you're offering this, all that kind of stuff. This is what I want it to look like.
Yep.
And that's really awesome because he came down to them as well. Like, you know, he started off on the mount on Mount Sinai with Moses, but then the whole point of them building the whole tabernacle was so that God could dwell amongst his people. In fact, the verb there is that he could tabernacle with his people, you know, like it's that dwelling place. And that's the whole, it's totally different. The laws were so that God could be with his people, not so that he would, like, I don't know, I guess lord it over them like the other gods in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, he still obviously is Lord and King and God, but it wasn't in a way that they all just had to be like ants and he's like on an anthill with a magnifying glass or something.
Well, that's why Psalm chapter 8 is probably my favorite chapter in Psalms, because the psalmist talks about how God has created mankind a little lower than the angels, but he has crowned mankind with glory and honor, that God has actually shared his glory. So that God's original idea was that ruling and reigning together in partnership would be the way that God would relate to human beings, that we would recognize the divinity with which we were made and exercise that divinity appropriately within the design of God's wisdom.
That's cool. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I hadn't connected that. Yeah, I guess that's the cool thing. It's like shows how much he values us and values relationship with us, even back then when we see this law and we see like, oh, he just wants us to do all of these things. But it's all about relationship. It's because he wants that relationship with us and he wants to dwell with us.
That's what he wants to do with the Israelite nation. He wants the Israelite nation to be his partner. He wants the Israelite nation to be like we talk about being God's representatives. Like, that's kind of like a fairly innocuous sort of phrase that we use. I feel like it's lost a little bit of meaning, but it's like literally God wants his people to be an extension of him, to be like, you know, like an ambassador. Like, we are, you know, we may be living on the earth. We might not be living in the heavenly realm or whatever, but we act as though we are representing to a divine level God's intentions, will, and wishes, and his heart to the nations around us. That's God's intention for Israel, and that's God's intention for us through Christ.
Yeah, that leads perfectly to my last point. So one of the commandments, the third commandment, it is a little bit hard to number the commandments, but the third commandment is like not using the Lord's name in vain, right? It's interesting. I mean, a lot of people think this is just like, if you stub your toe and then you say, oh my... which, I mean, you could mean in a very serious way. You could say, I'm in pain, Jesus, can you please help me? But obviously the thing is that you wouldn't use it.
Generally speaking.
Yeah, generally. Yeah. So a lot of people take it. I think that's how they read it, which is a very...
just don't swear.
Yeah, yeah. Like,
cuss.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know why. It seems like a very, like... I don't know why like that's the conclusion we come to from that. I mean,
right.
It's very strange to me, but because it's a lot deeper than that if you read into it. So the Bible Project does a really good episode on this with a certain scholar whose name has escaped me right now, but
Dr. Carmen something something.
Yeah, that sounds right.
We'll link it in the show notes anyway.
Yeah, yeah. And it's a really interesting idea that really plays into like what we're talking about today. But the whole thing is it would be more in line to say that God is putting his name on Israel. Just like how the priests, you know, they would wear like a chest piece that had these 12 precious gems, and each gem had like a name of each of the tribes engraved upon it. But then they would also wear something on their head that basically had something that says like property of God, property of Yahweh on it. That's what the priest would wear. And in the same way, the priests are like deeming everybody in Israel to be God's people, to be his chosen people. And so when God's laying out these laws, this wisdom, these teachings, he's laying out, here's what it looks like for you to bear my name. So don't go around and bear my name in a false way. Like, don't go and like, say you're my child, but then act totally different to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally different. It's totally different to just don't swear.
Yeah.
it's like we have become the people that he has put his name on.
Yeah.
And it's like a huge responsibility. Like, it's a huge responsibility. Like, the implication is that, you know, like, there are other people who have not had his name put on them, and we are representing him to them. And it's like, that's crazy. That's huge.
Yeah. And that's like, he wanted them to be like, I mean, we talk about it today, and it becomes very like Christianese thing, but it's like, you know, you're the hands and feet of Jesus, and that kind of thing, like you're being Christ to someone. But it was the same back then too. Like, they were representing how much better their God is to the world. They were his chosen people to go out and show the world the kind of people that God wanted them to be.
Yeah.
Who loved and cared for their neighbor, who would make sure the poor were looked after and the widowed and all that kind of thing. And you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's a huge, like you're saying, it's a huge responsibility. And that's why, like, I guess a side of me now understanding that can see why some of the punishments were quite harsh to us. But we're not there. It's hard when they're recounting this old story.
Mm.
It's hard to figure out exactly, like, was the punishment harsh? I don't know. Like, it's hard for us to put out, like, to be there. What am I saying? It's hard for us to, like, really put our feet in their shoes.
Right, right. Yeah. And as we talked about before, you know, we have the benefit of being 21st century people, and our temptation is to apply our moral compass to this very ancient text and get outraged when this ancient text that was written a different time, different culture, with different value sets, doesn't live up to our specific value set.
Yeah.
It's very, like, so when you think about it that way, it's like, on the one hand, I can understand why people would have an issue with the Bible. On the other hand, how can you have an issue with the Bible?
Yeah. 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 And so, like, I mean, I guess I can understand, like, if God's saying, no, you're not acting in accordance to how my people are meant to act.
Yeah.
And that's bad. You know, you're living in my promised land, whatever, like, and you're not being the people of the promised land.
Mm.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. Like, it's... And yeah, again, I mean, you read stuff about like the earth opening up and swallowing people, and you're like, okay, that seems a bit like over the top. Especially like when it, you know, when it includes like the women and the children as well, like the wives and the children.
Yes.
But I guess from our perspective, it's hard to, and again, this isn't an all-encompassing answer or anything. There's definitely room for questioning in this, but I guess it's more thinking, well, what would be better that the wife and children live their life, like continue to live their life in a life of like shame of what the husband had done and be like constantly isolated. I don't know. Like, cause even our modern day prison system, we think that's just because only the person who did the crime goes to prison. But then you think, well, it still affects the wife and the children their whole lives kind of thing. So it's not to judge anyone, but I'm just saying, like, it's not always like, I don't know if there is a perfect system, and it's hard to figure out what the best course of action is. But I can see why God was so serious about people genuinely representing him and wanting people to be his kind of people.
It's a shame that we have kind of obscured and neglected the actual significance of these ancient sections of the Hebrew Bible. Because I think that once I started to really understand what they were talking about and what they were leading Israel towards, it makes the later history of Israel much more meaningful and also more heartbreaking, because you see the ways in which God is leading Israel to become his covenant people, to be his priest of nations, to be this example to the world that would bless and would transform the entire world. Mm. And then you see the ways in which Israel just, like, it has these moments of absolute brilliance and hope, like, it's going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
The golden age of King David, where, you know, he's a man after God's own heart, or even Solomon, or some of the later kings who actually get it right. But then the actual sort of, the majority of Israel's history is really painful examples of what happens when human beings decide to go their own way and to just reject God's invitation to listen to his voice, to walk in his wisdom. Yeah.
And you see the fruits of that just play out over and over and over again. But that's, again, and this is my last point. After this, I'm done. You can say whatever you want. But my last point is the fact that even when they, as a nation, like as a collective, continue to break the law, continue to go against the wisdom of God, he would punish, but he would forgive over and over and over again. And he would bring them back. They would make the mistakes again. He might punish them. He might send them out for a bit. You know, but he just kept forgiving and kept bringing them back. And when they would repent, he would come back straight away. It's mind blowing to read it and see how many times God forgave them and came back. And then they just went and did their own thing again.
You could probably argue that there are more examples of grace in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew scriptures, than you could possibly find in the New Testament.
Ooh. Numerically, I would say, numerically, yes. But maybe in terms of size of grace, maybe? I don't know. Because Jesus... The death and resurrection of Jesus is like, that's paying for the sins of everybody, past, like, present, future.
Okay, that's like a trump card. That's like an insta-win card.
yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's like the bigger example of grace. But numerically... But
in terms of, like, you know, an entire nation stuffing up, and then getting enslaved or getting subjugated or getting oppressed, and then calling out to God, and then God comes in and rescues them, only to repeat this cycle again dozens more times until finally they're driven into exile. And even when they are driven into exile, God is continually writing them love letters saying, hey, things are really rough right now, but there is hope. There is somebody coming who is going to right all the wrongs, who's going to make rivers in the desert. Like, that's... I don't know how you cannot see grace in all of that, considering how much of a spoiled, ungrateful child Israel is throughout basically their entire history.
Yeah.
Bar those few moments.
Yeah. And that's the thing. It's like he laid all this out. And this, I guess, a summary. He's like, he laid it all out, like, after he'd already saved them. He laid it out clearly for them. He gave them wisdom that was practical, that would make them better and the nations around them better. He made it. He said, hey, this is serious. This is about bearing my name. And he forgave them over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And and yet we come along and say, oh, look how violent and horrible the God of the Old Testament is. You know what I mean? It's like, wow.
Yeah.
But you have to. It's definitely a series of books that you have to step back and look at the larger picture.
Yep.
It's not even something like it's also the kind of thing where you have to look at it in, like, you can't look at single people or single things in isolation. It's all to do with Israel as a nation, not individuals, if that makes sense.
Context is everything.
Yep.
Speaking of context, this week's episode is very much more of a broad overview and an introduction to this whole idea. We've definitely come to some conclusions, but we're not just going to leave it at that. We want to really dig into more specifics in the coming weeks. And again, we don't really know how long this is going to take and where this is exactly going to lead us. We've got a few things in mind. We definitely want to address the killing and the genocide thing. There are a couple of other things that we want to address as well. So as we move forward, we're going to get a little bit more specific. We are going to zero in on a few specific stories and specific moments in the Old Testament history. So I'm really excited to bust open the book and talk about some of these specifics. But I think one thing, and then I'm done, and we can move on from this. But I think if you guys have any specific questions or specific thoughts or want us to address anything other specific that is really burning, because there's heaps of this to draw upon, send us a message, send us an email. You guys know how to get in contact with us, but we'd love to hear about where you would kind of like us to move, and that might, you know, sort of help us to zero in on some of the stories that really matter and are really important to you guys.
Yeah. No, that's cool. Yeah, we'd definitely love to hear from you about that, because like about all this, because it will influence how the series continues. So yeah, let us know. And of course, the best place to find all things Burn the Haystack is burnthehaystack.org. So it links to our social media and also a direct contact form, so you can send us your thoughts directly.
Amazing. And if this is the first time that you've listened to an episode of Burn the Haystack, welcome. So glad to have you with us. If this is your 100th episode, welcome back, old friend. It's good to have you. if you would like to support Burn the Haystack, you can do so by leaving us a rating or a review on your podcatching app of choice. We would really appreciate it if you did that. It really helps us to get more exposure and get this podcast out to more people.
Yeah, absolutely. So thanks for listening. We love you. Stay awesome. That is Josh and Jesse.
Out!